Good afternoon. Welcome to the June panel of the Court of Appeals. We only have two cases on the panel today, and one of them, we have one of counsel by Zoom. So as usual, these cases are recorded and preserved for viewing. So to the extent you have any confidential information, names, juveniles, things like that, that you would like to keep private, just keep that in mind. I am pleased to be joined on my right by Judge Rico Bishop and on my left by Judge Larry Welch. And with that, we will go ahead and get started. Our first case of the day is Macy versus Macy. Macy versus Macy. Whenever you're ready.
If it may please the court, my name is Adam Richard Little of Nebraska Legal Group, and I am on the attorney for the appellant, Jeffrey Macy. I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please. Before I begin my argument, would the court like a brief recitation of the facts, or may I proceed?
I think you can proceed.
Okay. We bring two issues before the court today for argument. The first is that the district court's division of the marital estate was an abuse of discretion because it was inequitable. There were inclusion of several debts that were not marital in nature and incorrect allocation of valuation. The second issue is that a conditional judgment in equity is void where it does not determine the party's rights and obligations with reasonable certainty, which is what occurred in the case here today. The standard of review for this court in a dissolution of marriage action is review de novo on the record for an abuse of discretion. And when this court reviews the record de novo, we ask that the court reverse and remand on the issues of the division of the marital estate, including the void conditional judgment. Turning to the first issue, the division of the marital estate in this matter was inequitable. Now, property division is not subject to a precise mathematical formula, and the ultimate test for determining the appropriateness is reasonableness as determined by the facts of each case. Division of the marital estate is a three-step process: classification and identification of the assets and debts, valuation, and then allocation or division. The district court in this matter erred specifically on the issue of various debts that were included in the marital estate that should not have, the most egregious of which are the appellee's student loans. Now, this court has addressed the issue of inclusion of student loans in the marital estate on a couple of occasions, most recently in 2021 in Wright v. Wright. In that case, the husband submitted evidence of the total amount that was disbursed for his student loans, but failed to provide any itemization of how those expenses were utilized. And this court has also found in Walker v. Walker that assigning sole responsibility for student loans to the incurring spouse is equitable where that spouse takes the benefits of the decree with them.
This school debt was incurred during the marriage, correct?
That is correct.
So in order to prove it was non-marital, it was your client's burden, correct?
Your Honor, we believe that the burden was on the spouse who is incurring the student loans to prove what portion, if any, were incurred above and beyond the cost of the education.
So you suggested that in your brief. You're saying that, is that a different burden than the normal burden, meaning it's debt incurred during the marriage? Did, by virtue of the fact that it's school debt, does that change the burden? Because as to the person that incurred that debt, is that what you're suggesting?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. And I believe that's what this court's case in Wright v. Wright stands for, that there's a presumption that the personal student loans, the benefit of that education goes with the spouse who gets the degree. And because of that, there is a burden on the person incurring those student loans to show if any portion was incurred beyond the cost of that education, what it was, and that those were used for the benefit of the marriage.
So let me break that down real quick so I'm gonna make sure I understand your position. Even though that debt's incurred during the marriage, if it's school debt, as to the person that incurred the debt, you think the burden then is on them to prove that it was used for Well, whose burden is it then? How does that shift the normal burden of non-marital debt? That's the question.
Absolutely. So I think if we back up a little bit and look at what is a marital debt, that may help address this issue. And a marital debt is only one that is incurred for the benefit of the marriage. And here, the issue of the student loans is that the benefit of that is the education.
Isn't a marital debt a debt incurred during the course of the marriage?
It is. And the second portion of that is that it's incurred during the marriage for the benefit of the parties. And that's where I think this distinction with student loans is necessary, because when the party leaves with the benefit of that education, that's where that student loan should go with it, because the party who is has the education is the one who continues to benefit from that after the end of the marriage.
But don't both parties benefit during the marriage from that?
They can in that sense. This court and then both Wright and Walker looked at how that applied. Essentially, what was the purpose of those loans? How were they applied? And because she continues, the appellee continues to benefit from that after the marriage, there is a component of those debts, so that student loan, that should not be marital. And that's what the appellant's position is here today, that this court has found that in previous cases, and that we ask that the court continue that here and reverse the district court on that specific issue.
Isn't the part of the problem, though, is in those cases, the trial court had ruled against the person who incurred the debt. In this case, the trial court ruled in favor of the person who incurred the debt. So for us to look at it for an abuse of discretion is really, well, what does the record indicate? And was there enough there for the trial court to make that decision? So that we can't say it's an abuse of discretion, or we can say that, right? So from that perspective, we're looking at the entirety of the record. So it's a little different from the other cases.
Yes, that's correct. And that's really what we're arguing here about the abuse of discretion, is that those cases set forth what should be the standard or test in this specific issue. Where there are student loans, the party who's incurred them should show that they've taken out more than they needed for marital expenses.
But generally, like as Judge Welch was indicating, the burden is usually on the party trying to establish that a debt or an asset is non-marital, right? And I think you're suggesting that there should be a different standard when it comes to student loans, and I'm not sure where the authority might come from for that.
Right, and that we're asking the court simply to extend Wright and Walker on that burden shifting, because the nature of the student loans, the party who is incurring them is the one who has the most information. They have that ability to show what was incurred. For example, she could have provided information about the cost of the tuition, the cost of the books, or an itemization of what those marital expenses were. For example, if she took out an additional $10,000 to pay for rent or for food and things because she wasn't working, or that's just an example. That's what we're asking this court to find here today. Because that information does not exist in this record, it's difficult to determine that that was entirely a marital debt.
Since you have 3 minutes, it looks like, would you mind jump into the conditional judgment?
Absolutely. And I was going to suggest a conditional judgment in equity is void where it does not determine the party's rights and obligations with reasonable certainty. Now, this is kind of a unique issue. There's only been a few cases that have addressed that. The most on point is Strunk v. Cromie Strunk from 2006. And in that case, it dealt with a property settlement agreement that incorporated into the decree a provision, conditional provision, where if the party receiving the home sold it at a later date, an additional cash judgment was to be awarded to the other spouse. The Nebraska Supreme Court, as a matter of first impression, found that while normally conditional judgments are void across the board, it was permissible in a court of equity. And so the issue here in our case, we all agree, both the court, the expert witness, the record all show that this was a conditional judgment. It is trying to establish division of retirement benefits should those benefits vest at a later date.
But that's not unusual, Ryan. I mean, we have cases where people are not yet fully vested, and we have decrees that will address how that's going to be apportioned in terms of percentage or dollar amount or something to that effect. In this case, I understand it's a little different because of the possibility of Mr. Macy being able to reenlist or perhaps get a federal position that would allow him to, quote, buy back in his benefits. So if we were to accept that you could have a provision to address it, my question is, But what about all this other language that the court just kind of copied and pasted into the decree? Is that appropriate? Or does it go too far in terms of trying to lay out the possibility of this change in the future?
It's a delicate balancing act, and it's one our position as the appellant is that the district court did not properly balance that. We agree that there may be issues where we need to address the future vesting of that. The problem is that even the expert witness in this case, Mr. Astley, specifically testified that there are provisions that the court would have to consider in evaluating the final order, and the trial court did not. It simply photocopied the letter, the suggested language that Mr. Astley had proposed. One of the biggest problems here is if Mr. Macy were to re-enlist, or excuse me, to become a federal civil service employee and were to convert a portion of that military retirement, there would have to be a buy-in. And there's nothing in here that indicates how much Ms. Macy, if anything, would have to provide, which would give her a significant windfall. It also does not anticipate the changing legal landscape of what may exist and the conditions that may be imposed on Mr. Macy upon re-enlistment. It's a very difficult issue to address, and one simply that the court here went too far in trying to nail down the creation of, for example, a completely separate future retirement account and division of an asset that does not exist on the day of the decree.
What about like the survivor benefit is a very substantial benefit that this order essentially mandates? Was there any evidence to indicate whether Ms. Macy was even eligible for that benefit or would be to the extent he obtained federal employment and continued his retirement?
And Your Honor, I see I'm out of time. May I briefly respond and conclude?
Please.
Okay. Exactly. The survivor benefit is one that has very specific conditions to it. There is not sufficient evidence on the record on how that would be acquired, what conditions must be met, the cost, and even if it could be awarded. And so that is something by blanket including that, it makes this judgment here very problematic. And because of that, it is one of those conditional orders that would be void and is subject to attack in this instance. And we ask the court to reverse and remand on that. We would stand on the arguments in our brief on the remaining issues, and thank you for your time.
Thank you. Appley, whenever you are ready to proceed.
Good afternoon, and thank you for the opportunity to appear via Zoom. It's a lifesaver for those of us in Western Nebraska. My name is Rhonda Flower, and I represent the appellee slash cross appellant here, Megan Macy. My client is asking the court to affirm the lower court's ruling with regards to the division of the marital estate and asking the court to reverse and remand with regards to the issue of custody and alimony. I will address these issues in the same order as Mr. Little, just for the sake of everyone's sanity, specifically starting with the issue of the student loans. As this court is well aware, this issue is a fact-driven issue. And I believe the burden was on my client in this particular case to provide an adequate record of how these loans were utilized. The appellate court, I would stress, must give weight to the fact that the trial court heard the testimony and observed the witnesses and chose to believe Megan's versions of the facts with regards to this specific issue. If you look back at what we can glean from the evidence and testimony, we know that Megan incurred just over $27,000 in student loans during the marriage. She testified that $4,000 of these funds went to pay for a diamond ring that the appellant purchased for, and that about $8,000 went to pay for her master's degree. And I think this next part is important. She testified that the balance of those funds went to pay living expenses of the parties. Specifically, she testified that the lion's share of the loans were taken out in the early years of the marriage before she started to student teach. And it's important to note that the appellant does admit that on cross-examination in his testimony, and specifically stated that he was well aware that student loan funds went to pay living expenses as it was necessary to use those funds as such because money was tight and Megan was not working at the time. If the proceeds of the loans were used solely for paying for my client's education, I think that would certainly strengthen the appellant's argument on this issue. But we have a situation where at least a substantial chunk of these loans was used for the joint benefit of the parties. And that happened in a couple of different ways. They were used to support the family well before she could begin to work. They allowed her to progress in her career and to obtain employment, which resulted in her student teaching between 2014 and 2018. It's important to note that she also testified that during that period of time that she was student teaching, that those funds went into the joint account and were specifically used to pay for groceries and to pay for the twins' activities. And I believe it was in sometime in 2018, she resigned her teaching position because the parties had relocated from Maryland back to San Diego. They knew another military move was looming in the near future. They weren't happy with the school district they were in San Diego. So they, both parties agreed they were going to leave the twins at home and my client was going to homeschool them. I can't think of a better benefit to the family than to teach your own children and have a qualified and certified teacher to do that. So in addition to the funds going to defer living expenses while they were still together, it allowed her to obtain a career that allowed her to contribute to financially to the marriage. And it provided her with a situation where she was in a position to homeschool their children. It just appears obvious to me that this family benefited from the use of these student loans. And as such, I think the trial court was completely accurate in terms of including those debts in the marital estate. I would also note that I believe Megan did provide the court with an adequate record as to how the funds were utilized. And I think the trial court believed that testimony with regards to Megan and based upon that made the decision that it did. With regards to the conditional judgment.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, I need to get closer to the mic. The district court did exclude one of the student loans of about $9,000. Is that right?
Yeah, and if you look at the record, there is some confusion on that. Megan was adamant, and I it adds to the confusion because she gave a couple of different figures when she testified. She was adamant that she didn't have more than $700 in student loans at the time the parties were married. In fact, she was still operating under the GI Bill because she had been in the Guard before herself. So she was unclear where that figure of $9,000 in premarital student loans came from. And I think that's clear on the record. With regards to the issue of the conditional judgment, Mr. Little and I both rely heavily upon this case of Strunk versus Strunk. But I think what that case makes clear is that conditional orders are expressly allowed, especially in the division of marital property. And according to Strunk, what we need to do is be able to determine a party's rights and obligations with reasonable certainty. And I would stress to the court that these military credits are a potentially valuable asset. And I appreciate the fact that the trial court did not leave that asset laying on the table. We attempted through Adam Astley and specifically Exhibit 43, which is the language that the trial court cut and pasted. The trial court attempted to preserve that unvested asset and prevent Megan from having to resort to post-judgment litigation down the road. Now, I must concede, I think the trial court failed to address something in its order. As Mr. Little had indicated, the trial court essentially cut and pasted from Exhibit 43 into its order. But Adam testified on pages 183 and 184 of the Bill of Exceptions that there was one thing that the trial court had to try and figure out, and that was how to fairly and equitably allow Megan to buy in the event that the appellant tried to buy back his 13 years of service. And I think this really can be resolved pretty easily. I think the appellant is making it much more difficult than it needs to be. According to Exhibit 43 and the lower court's order, the appellant needs to notify Megan if he chooses to participate in a FERS account and buy back his years of service. The order should have gone on to provide that Megan should have the opportunity to contribute to this buy-in. If she does, great, then she gets her share of the payout. If she opts not to participate in the buy-in, then she gets no portion of the buyout. I think it's really that simple in terms of clarifying that issue in the lower court's ruling.
But that wouldn't address the amount of the buy-in. I mean, if the purpose of this is to prevent further litigation down the road, further litigation really is inevitable if this ultimately becomes a benefit that can be quantified, right?
Right. And I think how best it's handled is Megan is entitled to half of those military credits that accrued during this approximately 13 years that he was in the service while they were married. It seems logical that if he chooses to buy these back, that she should be held responsible for half of the cost of the buy-in. She then in return reaps half of the rewards at the time of the payout. And if she simply can't afford to or chooses not to, then she wouldn't receive any portion of the buyout.
So our courts have already talked about the right to take these unvested pensions and divide. They don't have to be vested in order to make a contingent order of this nature. The Supreme Court's already spoken to that. I guess Right. The question in my mind is, what do you have to provide in that order as it relates to that contingency when, you know, we're at the 12-year mark and you have to get to 20 or you have to buy, but like, you know, going on and on about some formulas and the like when we don't even know what's going to happen? Or is it just sufficient to say, listen, I'm going to award this to her, and then in the event that it happens, we're going to come back in here and figure out what 50% of that means? I mean, how far does the court have to go in that regard?
Right. And there is a formula that they use, and it's based upon the number of service months that he had while they were together, divided by the total months of employment and combined service years. I don't know, and to be honest, I don't know that post-judgment litigation is totally avoidable here, but I think based upon Exhibit 43 and what the court incorporated from that into its judgment or its decree, I think with some final revisions, it can be at least sufficient to protect my client's interest in what is potentially a really valuable asset. It was frustrating to my client because this military retirement could have very well been the biggest marital asset. And when he resigned his commission, it vaporized that asset. With that, I see I'm out of time.
Okay, thank you. The appellant is out of time, so the case is submitted and counsel is excused. Thank you for joining us via Zoom.
Thank you.
Thank you both.